This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Symbiosis: Why We Need Writing Buddies.
So I guess before we start, Jules, you are my writing buddy.
You're my writing buddy too. I'm not very good. I genuinely meant that, but it came out sounding all sarcastic because it was very sentimental. I'm so rubbish at this.
Oh, the insincerity.
That's just it. I was trying to be sincere. I should just not try to be sincere. It comes out wrong. No, all joking aside, yes, you are my writing buddy as well. I have a couple of writing buddies, and they're basically for different things.
Yeah, I think the problem is that when we talk about having a writing buddy, because we use writing buddy rather than writing buddies,
yeah.
People tend to think you can only have one, and that's simply not true. Having several, having a group, makes a big difference.
Well, everybody's got different strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
Well, so it's good to have a few. I would say, actually, that you were not just my writing buddy, you're probably actually my ideal reader. In the sense of just very, if I look at it very cold-bloodedly, you connect with my characters quite well. I really enjoy making you upset with my writing. But I'm also writing for you, for someone who has the same sort of reactions and involvement that you have in what I've written. So, you know, in that respect, I'd say you're an ideal reader. Whereas if you take someone like Stephen King, he writes for his wife. It's one of those things where it's just a bit of a coincidence that she's his wife as well. She is actually his ideal readership.
Yeah, you know, it makes sense as well, because I am sort of not your target audience, but I sort of am within that bracket as well.
Yeah.
So I am a good sample reader for your stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
So go quickly through your different writing buddies and their different sort of roles in your writing.
We're both part of this group. We're both part of a group called the Random Writers, Random and Speculative Short Story Appreciation Society, which just basically took on a life of its own in the 3 years since I started it. And we've got a really nice group of people there who are all very different, all very diverse in how they write and what they write. And I wouldn't say that everybody in the group completely connects with what I write. I don't completely connect with what everyone writes, but everyone has at least a few people who connect with them, and we make a good group together.
Yeah.
And, you know, we obviously do so well that we've actually produced 3 anthologies between us, so that's a pretty good indicator of a successful writing group. I would loosely call all the randoms, like, my writing buddies, because I could put something up, and even if they didn't really like it, they'd be able to give me constructive criticism on it.
Yeah.
But the very specific writing buddies, there's obviously you, and you fall under ideal reader as well. And then there's Shell, who actually works more as an alpha reader. She's a good person to discuss construction, structure, ideas, and, you know, whether something works in the direction it's going, or whether it's a little bit twee or a bit trite. Or occasionally, when I just let the writing just sort of come out, it sort of goes... Sometimes I will write something in that is just so stupid, and I'm looking at it thinking, that's really stupid. But part of me, the lazy part, is trying to see if I can get it under the wire anyway. So she's quite good at calling me on that. And then there's Matt Willis as well, who, a different sort of writing buddy, really. And actually one that I ended up collaborating with, not just on the 3 anthologies, but on 2 novels, which is a completely different dynamic again. So talk about that a bit later.
I do want to talk about that, because I want to talk about the issue of commas.
Yeah, but, well, that's the thing, you see. You've got too many, I've never got enough, and Matt always carries exactly the right number. So it's sort of like Goldilocks and the 3 Bears.
So, yeah, I'm a similar setup. I have... several writing buddies. You are obviously one of them. And I have probably one of my alpha reader. is Amelia McKenzie, who came on last year onto the show, talking about her steampunk novel, Ars Moriendi. And Amelia is my alpha reader, and she's also very good at picking up a lot of my grammatical errors, and making sure that I'm showing rather than telling. I mean, she's fantastic with the whole thing. She calls me up, and she definitely calls me out when I'm being lazy, which I do fairly frequently, and especially when I ramble. I have very long, just very, very long books, and she can cut them down to size. And then what my usual process is, I send things to her, and then I send them to you, because you are an ideal reader as far as I'm concerned, because you are, first of all, within the bracket of the you know, the people I'm writing for, but also you're insanely well read.
I don't think I am, but.
You are, okay, Jules, you are. If anyone, if I need to talk to anyone about books, it's you. We started a podcast together. Do you remember?
Oh yeah, that.
So you are insanely well read, and you've read a variety, you know, of different quality works, and because of that, you have a great perspective about not just genre and what. And genre fiction, but writing styles, quality, and you're always honest about it as well, which is incredibly important.
Actually, that's something you really want from a writing buddy, is somebody who's honest, but
yeah,
and doesn't just tell you what you want to hear, but, ideally isn't cruel about it.
I've been teaching my class, my first years at university, and we started doing workshopping. And my general rule, I think I've said this before, is that you find three criticisms for every compliment, because criticisms improve, compliments empower. And so you need to have a balance of the two. And if you're just constantly empowering someone without actually criticizing their work, then that means that if their work isn't actually that good, they feel their work is better than it is, and then they're disappointed when they don't get the mark that they necessarily want, or the mark they probably deserve, because they think that the first draft is all that they need, when actually a little bit of criticism could have pushed them up to the quality. I think the problem is that people have this illusion that writers just get something out and it's just perfect.
Yeah.
And that's never the case. And a crucial part of the writing process is sharing the work with trustworthy individuals before you submit it to anything.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think people on the outside, writing looks almost like a romantic profession. You know, I suppose it is from a distance, but it's also a lot of sitting on your own in front of a computer or a typewriter or a pad of paper. And,
bizarrely, or a chisel. Sorry.
Yes, if you want to be really archaic about it. It really depends what materials you've got available. Yeah, and it's a lot of being by yourself, which is good, because I quite like spending time by myself in my own head. But at the same time, it's not something you can really finish and perfect in isolation.
No.
Because if you're writing and you want someone else to read it, then you need to be writing for your audience.
So, yeah.
A way station is to expose it to people who have your best interests at heart, but at the same time are not going to pull any punches over stuff that you've done that's lazy or a bit stupid.
Yeah, which is incredibly important. And I think it's, yeah, there's a very big difference between constructive criticism and just criticism.
Yes.
And you want a writing buddy who can provide constructive criticism, so don't just turn around and say, well, this is rubbish, but, you know, turn around and say, you can do better, and here's how you can do better, or I don't agree with the way you've done this, or this character actually should just be cut entirely. Which no one actually wants to hear, but...
No one wants to hear that, and no one wants to hear, you know what, your book's like 150 pages too long. It's really making the pace sag. That hasn't happened to me yet, but, you know, more and more books that I've read recently seem to, and it's very noticeable that it's from established authors who've been popular. And
yeah.
what I think is happening is that they're just submitting their work and it's going through the editing process. And because they're well known and they're making money, less time is being spent on the editing, conversely, partly because authors in that position sometimes have the clout to say, I don't want to listen to these editorial changes. And the publishers will say, well, okay, it's going to make us money anyway, so I'll go along with it.
Yeah.
Also partly because, you know, if publishers know it's going to sell anyway, why are they going to waste time trying to edit it even more?
Yeah.
So it puts the ball back in the author's court to try and make it much more perfect. And sometimes if you're working to a deadline, you're so close to it, you cannot physically see. So unless they've got a super team of beta readers or whatever,
yeah,
it can get quite difficult.
And I think that there's something to be said about people who do have writing buddies, who are tough on them. And it does make a big difference because it's as you say that, but there are some established authors who, no matter what they produce incredible work.
Yeah.
And it's because they're tough on themselves and because they have readers who expect perfection from them, know the quality of the standard of work that they can produce and will not take anything less.
Yeah. One of the two examples recently that I read were The Chemist by Stephanie Meyer, which was her foray into suspense mystery thrillers or spy thrillers.
I didn't realise she'd...
I wouldn't let anyone read it. There's a couple of bits in it that are reasonable, and she's clearly put a lot of work into this, and she's really tried to establish something that's different and separate from Twilight, but it falls flat, in my opinion, and part of the reason it falls flat is it's 200 pages too long, so it just doesn't work in that respect. Structurally, it's unsound. Another one I read recently is Carve the Mark by Veronica Roth, which I actually thought I wouldn't read, but then I did. And that's actually not bad. It's a reasonable, okay young adult novel. It's obviously attracted a lot of criticism recently, but I won't go into that now. Again, that's about 150 pages too long. It doesn't need to be that long. But obviously, their books sell.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just thinking as a serial overwriter. I really can't judge other people. No, I can. I can judge them, definitely judge them, whilst being totally aware of the fact that I suffer from the flaw of not being able to write short things.
Well, there's a difference between having a natural tendency to writing longer bits of work and writing longer bits of work that don't say anything for like 150 pages.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. So, yes, writing buddies. Let's go a little bit more into the different kinds, because we mentioned alpha readers and we mentioned betas.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind expanding a little bit more on that and sort of the differences between them and what, you know, people can expect if they find them. And also, you know, the difference between an alpha, a beta, and an editor, a creative editor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's tons and millions of trillions of words. So I'm throwing the ball in your court.
Okay, well, to start off with a quote from the late Terry Pratchett, which was, the first draft is just the author telling the story to themselves.
I like that.
And it's one that I pull out every so often, because when you start getting stuck on a first draft, you have to remind yourself that nobody else is going to set eyes on it, so it doesn't matter. You're literally just working out how to get from point A to point B in your own words, in your own time. And I think the reason that a lot of first drafts don't get completed is the fact that people just sort of get paralysed about halfway through. But where your alpha reader would mean is probably very close to after the first draft. You might take the first draft and tweak it a little bit and think, oh, that's stupid, I'm going to cut that out.
Yeah.
And you might do what, say, I do with Chell, which is we exchange chapters. Sort of
yeah.
one chapter or one half a chapter a day kind of thing. And look through it and critique it. And then you've got an ongoing sort of narrative about what's happening in your book. It's not the same as having, say, a beta reader completely read the entire draft or read a big section of it, sort of like 50 pages or whatever, and get back to you. So it's slightly different. But I think the advantage of doing it as an alpha reader is that you really do shake out any irregularities in structure, any bits that really don't look like they will. if you've got a character coming on and suddenly they've changed names, that gets picked up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So those sort of things, the major flaws. What an alpha reader doesn't tend to do is go into things like word choice, whether the voice sounds really authentic, and whether all the characters sound like themselves rather than just the author trying on different hats.
Yeah. That kind of falls to the beta reader.
Yes.
Now the beta reader kind of is a little bit sort of doesn't necessarily have one role so much as they kind of pick up the slack on all of the others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
They
see a full copy of the manuscript after it's been sort of edited by the author once or twice.
Yeah. And if you think that, if you think of it like sculpting, the author, the first draft is the author basically planning it out. So that's them drawing the image that they want to sculpt. After the alpha is done, you have the sort of the general shape after amendments have kind of been made. And the beta reader is the one who turns around and looks at the whole thing as a whole. With the amendments and says, right now, this needs to be smoothed down, that needs to be smoothed down, that needs to be, you know, brushed up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they're the ones who kind of smooth the whole thing over, and they're the ones who make it go from just a story to a pleasurable reading experience.
Yeah, I think so. And the sort of feedback you'd look for from a beta reader is someone who can come back and say, well, you know, the book works as a whole, ideally, or it doesn't work as a whole, and here's why. Here's the bits I liked about it, here's the bits I didn't like. And again, you're looking at things like, well, that character just doesn't fit in, or you've got a subplot here and I can't see that it's supporting anything. Why is it there?
Sorry. Subplot. Sorry. I can't.
You can't see me, but I'm raising my eyebrows at you.
Sorry. No. Ignore me. I'm just thinking of all the criticisms that you've given me. Anyway,
my God, that makes it sound really dire. What did I say that made you laugh?
No, it's fine. And just, I mean, it's not just you, it's also Amelia. Just people just say, like, why has this even happened? I'm like, no, it's justified because this happens in the net. Get rid of it. Okay.
Because you like that little bit, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fairness, subplots are a bit of a bugbear of mine.
Yeah, I love them. I keep hold of them.
Subplots, but I just want them to work. You know, they must earn their place.
I think the other thing is that there are a lot of people who actually just skip straight to the beta reader.
Yes, without rewriting.
Yeah, which
very weird.
It's weird, but it also, I mean, it depends because I don't think you need to have an alpha writer, an alpha reader. If you yourself become the alpha reader.
No, you don't absolutely have to. You know, every writer has to choose their own path, as it were. I find it quite useful.
Yeah, no, it is quite useful, especially if this is a completely new piece of work. If it's a piece of work that maybe you've already been working on, then you can probably actually go straight to a beta reader. And beta readers can actually become alpha readers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a clear divide. You can have people swapping back and forth. Or you might find that you don't need an alpha for one series and you do for another.
Yeah. And also the same person can be your alpha reader and then your beta reader.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've read multiple drafts of people's novels before, various different things. And it in some ways it helps to have a beta reader who does that because that means they can see how it's progressed.
Yeah.
It also helps then to get somebody completely different to read it, so you get a fresh perspective as well.
Yeah, and then you need is it Omega? Omega's the third one? Alpha, Beta.
It's not one I've used, to be fair.
Then you need an Omega reader. No, because I tend to find if you've been both the Alpha and the Beta reader, after that, it's actually a good idea to let someone else read the manuscript as it is, because you kind of become indoctrinated as well.
Yeah.
So having fresh eyes again to sort of be able to advise is quite important.
Yeah, it's like only fighting the same person at karate, because what often is you'll just get very attuned to how they fight.
Yeah.
Which means when you fight someone different, you'll get smacked in the face.
And it also means, like, you can sometimes become unconscious of cuts and things like that.
Yeah.
Because if you understand what's going on, then something can make total sense to you in the same way that it makes total sense to the writer. And then to someone who has no, who's coming blind into the story, it wouldn't make any sense because something important has been removed and hasn't been replaced.
Yeah, I've certainly done that.
We've all done that, Jules.
And it was basically that I just was a bit click happy and I took out a massive paragraph, just one paragraph, but it meant that something else did not make sense later on.
Yeah. And it's actually really, really easy to do that. And it's what, another reason why beta readers are important is because you do need the fresh perspective.
So the question we were most likely to get asked is, how do you get a beta reader? There's a little ritual you can do.
Yeah, I find that if you go into the woods at night, if you go to libraries, lay out a snare,
you
catch
did.
Librarian, they'll hiss and sort of scratch you a little bit, but, you know, just tie them up in your basement. If you give them books, they calm down. Books and biscuits and tea, and they're fine after that. It's worked for me.
Madeline's handbook of how to catch a librarian. For your own personal use.
That's
that probably
dark.
Would work, actually. How many have you got now?
Just a few. You're the first one I didn't have to catch. You came of your own volition.
You waved a book at me. What did you expect?
So how to get a beta reader. Trying to get a beta reader is quite scary sometimes because I think we are all naturally very frightened of the idea of someone stealing our intellectual property.
I'm more worried about anyone seeing it full stop. I'm getting better. I am definitely better at that.
Yeah, we don't want to share our work because we don't want other people to see it. We don't want other people to take it. We don't want other people to judge it. So finding a beta reader is quite difficult. And I tend to find that some of the best beta readers are writers themselves.
Yeah, that definitely helps. I think if you can have a mixture of writers and people who just like reading,
That's
the best thing. I haven't completely managed that, but, you know, something to work on for the future. And writers have said they've had a lot of success getting beta readers by advertising on their website saying, you know, if you're interested in becoming a beta reader or joining the beta reader program for such and such a series, they can sign up for it, or they do it through their author newsletters. And it might be something that I try some point in the future.
Yeah.
You know, I'll offer ARC copies or whatever. So you can do it. You can do it that way. But I mean, those are beta readers really that you're looking at for sort of when you're almost there and you just want anyone to catch any last little mistakes before you.
Yeah. The alternative, if you have gone to, if you've ever attended a writing festival or done a professional writing course of any description or been to university, is to hang on to your classmates. That is certainly how I got Amelia. She was a fellow graduate from creative writing at the University of Winchester. And I got hold of you, Jules, because we were both working in the same publishing place.
Yeah, and I think I can't remember how that came about, really. I think we just agreed to read each other's books.
Yeah, we did. Turned out quite well.
Yeah. No, it definitely helps if you've got, as you say, some sort of connection with, or a writing forum as well. Spend time on a writing forum. Don't go on there saying, I'm looking for such and such, help me with this. But go on there and start to make connections with people. There's no slow route to this. Show that you're interested in other people and in their work. Try and critique, and they'll quite often critique you in return.
Yeah, it is a relationship. When you have a writing buddy, you know, it isn't a one-sided relationship. Very often writing buddies do exchange work, and it's the you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back kind of mentality, which is that you will be honest about what you're reading and give me good feedback, and I will do the same for you. And that's ultimately what both parties want, and so both parties do it well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, as we say, the symbiotic relationship. It's not parasitical. You haven't got one person constantly taking and the other one not.
Yeah.
In fact, if you find yourself in that situation where you're constantly giving critique and constantly reading or something for the other person and they're never doing anything for you, then you're probably better off ending that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Or at least not prioritising them, because the one thing that we can't get back is time, ultimately. And if you're a writer, the reason that it's not cold-blooded to say, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It's a case of we're exchanging our time.
Yeah.
So I'll put time into you if you'll put time into me. And it works quite well that way.
It does. It does. And it's just, it's amazing how your own ideas can flow better when discussion happens.
Yeah, definitely.
If you're only thinking of things yourself, then you're only, you know, it's just bouncing a ball off a wall. It's always going to come back at you. Yeah. Whereas if, you know, there's someone else there, they can prompt different things in your mind. So it can still be entirely your own original idea. But, you know, it was the whole kind of the Sherlock Holmes thing where Watson inspired genius in Sherlock. Watson never came up with the answers, but he somehow helped Sherlock figure them out for himself.
Yes.
Everyone needs a Watson.
Yes.
And you can. And the nice thing is that you can be someone else's Watson as well.
Yeah, definitely. Probably the best... best writing buddy relationships are where you find someone whose characters and stories you really engage with, and the same is true for them, because that way you've got two people getting really excited about the same world and the same characters. So, you know, and you can torture each other, which is, yeah, it's fun, let's be honest.
And blackmail opportunities arise
and blackmail each other. Yeah. There's, yeah, hostages on both sides.
There's hostages on both sides, which is very, very true. Jules and I have been holding our characters hostage from one another for the last few books, yeah, haven't we, Jules?
We have.
And so far we've come to a kind of a cold standstill, an agreement on certain things and certain issues.
Yes, certain people get to live as long as certain other people get to live.
Yes. But if that trust is betrayed, I will murder every single character in the Hamartia cycle just to get back at you.
George R. R. Martin will have nothing on you.
I do sometimes wonder about doing that, building up an entire world and then just literally murdering them all.
I'm sure it's very therapeutic, but you wouldn't have very many readers left at the end.
No, I think... No, but let them all get to the end like they're gonna live and then kill them all. There'd probably be a lot of complaints.
Yes. I think that comes under cheating your reader. To believe one thing and then you've taken it all away.
Yep. So yeah, that kind of relationship is very important. And actually, it's important in another way, because it makes the writing process, and rather actually, it makes the editing process enjoyable. I think a majority of the comments Amelia has left for me, and that I've left for Amelia, and that we've done for each other, Jules, are not comments on an improvement. They're just funny comments.
Yeah, in fairness, that bit of Cornish in Blood of the Delphi. And of course, I learned some Cornish for I Am the Silence, and I read it and went, "Oh my god, that's a really long-winded way to say that." which I won't spoilify for you, but it was very funny. And yes, I commented on that because that amused me greatly.
Yes, you put sad faces a couple of times as well.
I did. You were making me sad.
Yes, and Amelia has just piled abuse on me over and over and over again. When she was doing the alpha read, or well, rather beta read for the second edition of The Sons of Thestion, she just finished editing Blood of the Delphi. And she went back and read The Sons of Thestion and was finding all of the foreshadowing that I put in there. And so it was just torrents of abuse. Torrents of abuse from her as she furiously realised that I'd told her exactly what was going to happen pretty much from chapter one.
I got the same thing from you for I Belong to the Earth, though, because every time you came across a reference to Beth, I got this little message saying, just fuck Beth, seriously.
Yes. Screw you, Beth. No one likes you.
Oh, poor Beth. my ass.
And it does make it bearable, because writing is lonely.
Yeah.
And actually, when you're writing the first draft, it's not that bad. But editing, you know, they say writing's lonely. Editing is the lonely bit. It really is horrifically lonely, and it takes an incredibly long time. And you really get stuck in this one place that just takes over your world. So having some other people there with you who will liven it up, who will make it exciting, who will refresh it and give it vivacity, just, I think it makes it possible. And I think that a lot of the reasons why people have given up on projects is that they didn't have other people who were excited about it helping them along.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, having somebody who writes alongside you with something else is fantastically motivational.
Yeah.
So I've said that I do, obviously, chapter exchanges with Shell. And the fact that we know that we're going to be letting the other person down if we don't have something to give them means that you will write that number of words each day so that you're literally exchanging. It's almost like paying a debt in a good way.
My debt is repaid.
But I think it's also, it's having somebody who is a wailing wall for you as well, so that when it feels hopeless, like when you've reached the 30,000 word slump or whatever, wherever it happens for you, and everything feels hopeless, and you're like, I don't know who's going to read this anyway, because that happens no matter, several times during the production of a book. There's a, no one is going to read this, no one wants to read this crap, this is a mess kind of thing.
Yeah.
Having someone who goes, yeah, but I want to read it, I want to know what happens next, is really helpful. It's not just stroking your ego.
Yeah. And it can also really help you get to know your characters.
Yeah.
And get you to sort of question things, because at the core of any story is a question. And sometimes we get stuck on writing, not because we don't know what's going to happen, but because we don't know what the question is. We don't know the right question, which means that we can't figure out what the answer is. And having someone from the outside looking in, they can ask those questions. They can, yeah, but why is this character like this? Oh, why is that character like that? That would actually be something interesting to explore in this next bit. Or, but why does this have to happen? Well, I don't know. Why does this have to happen? Does it have to happen? Actually, it doesn't have to happen. You know, it makes a big, big difference to have just another voice in there.
Yeah, definitely. And also, there are, it will improve your writing technique as you go along.
Yeah.
Being too insular and doing too much of it by yourself means that you won't pick up on some of the failings or weaknesses. Whereas if someone else is reading it at regular intervals, then they'll pick up things and your technique will get better.
Yes, exactly.
That's if you're receptive to receiving critique.
Which is another important one. So let's talk a little bit about that. Now, when I first read I Belong to the Earth, I made a critique about the beginning of the book.
Which I think was fair.
And when I made that critique, I thought, oh God, Jules is going to hate me. We were still building up our friendship at that point. And I didn't hear anything from her after I made that critique. So I thought, oh God, she hates me. But it wasn't a critique made in you know, anger or a malicious critique. It was an honest opinion. Which has been corrected in the new edition.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I still think it can be improved, because I still am learning. You never stop learning writing, but I was still really learning the craft at that particular point in time, and I still think the first five chapters are a bit clunky. But I'm not going to George Lucas the whole thing, keep picking away at it and never do anything else, so that's a case of, well, I've tried to smooth it out a bit and we'll see how it goes from here. Maybe there'll be a third edition at some point in the future, but it's best to leave it alone. But
yeah. No,
it was a fair point. It was something that I was on some level aware of. And other people have said, well, it's a bit slow to start with. And I'm like, yeah, I think it is, in fairness.
Yeah. And I've received similar critiques. And I think the other important thing to remember is that these critiques aren't just necessarily for one book, but they can inform how you then write from then on.
Yeah.
And you know, we said no one wants to receive critique. No one wants to have worked hard on something and then to be told that they need to work more. You know,
it's like, this would be really good if you fixed this. It's like, I spent 30 hours on that. What are you talking about?
Yeah, but no one wants to do that. We just want to be congratulated and patted on the head and given chocolate.
Of of course, if you ever do that, then we're going to be massively suspicious that you actually mean it. So it's a no-win situation. But there are some people who genuinely don't want to hear anything except how great they are.
And yeah.
You need to work out if you're critiquing somebody, whether they want a pat on the head or whether they genuinely want to hear the truth, but critique them. Because it will save you a lot of heartache when they turn around and completely go off on one at you. I'm part of the Word Cloud, which is the Writers' Workshop writing forum, which is where the random writers hang up their hats.
Yeah.
And there are people who I've seen on there who've asked for critique, and when they've received critique, honest, reasonable, sort of, I think you ought to think about trying to do this, this isn't very strong, kind of, you know, reasonable critique, they've completely gone off on one and effed and blinded and been really quite abusive.
Yeah. Which is not the correct, which is not the correct way to respond to critique.
No, I mean, you might feel really angry and you might feel like kicking everything over and throwing your toys out of the pram. And if you feel like that, the best thing to do is walk away and come back to it when you calm down.
Yeah, because I think actually for the most part, it's very reasonable to feel angry when you've been critiqued, especially if, you know, it is something you've worked hard on. And you maybe even feel that the critique is not justified. But there's no point responding in anger because, you know, 8 times out of 10, you'll actually come back and say, this critique is reasonable. And it's not, and 8 times out of 10, it is not, the critique is not coming from a bad place. It is coming from a place of genuine interest, because no one critiques something unless they've been interested by it. No one, unless they just want to be horrible. You know, some people do it just for the kick of telling other people they're rubbish. But for the most part, beta readers and alpha readers are doing it because they care. They care about a piece of work and they want it to be good. So they do critique it because they want it to be even better. So that if you get angry at them, it's a little bit like saying, I've spent several hours looking at your work. You know, I've given my time to be able to, and considered this properly, to be able to find a way to make it even better for you. I mean, the beta reader isn't getting anything out of it. They don't get anything out of it, whether, you know, your work improves or it doesn't. They've done this for you. And for you to then turn around just in rage and say, no, you're wrong, without any consideration is, yeah.
I mean, I have seen threads where someone who, I wouldn't say they were even trolling. I think what they were trying to do was build up interest in their editing business, which was rubbish, by the way. So what they did was they tore down perfectly reasonable pieces of writing that just had the normal number of flaws.
Yeah.
Some of the most unhelpful, unpleasant and quite abusive comments. For example, this is one of the more pleasant things this person I'm thinking of said was, yes, okay, in that case, I'll admire the black writing on the white background. There you go, I've admired one thing about your writing. Which is incredibly patronising.
That is incredibly patronising and not at all helpful, not in the least.
No.
And yeah, that is someone who's not doing it for the right reason. They're not a beta reader, they're there to sort of promote their own business.
And I've seen other people who said, well, this is shit. And it's like, well, that's useless, because why? Okay, maybe it is. Unless you can tell them why, for you, that's shit, then your critique is worthless.
Yeah, exactly. That being said, you are allowed to disagree with critique.
Yes.
And I've definitely had, you know, people suggest I make changes, and I've sort of thought about it and then respectfully declined. And I usually have an explanation for that. And the reason I am able to decline is that they said, I suggest you change this because of this. And I've turned around and said, actually, I'm going to do it for this. I'm going to keep it for this reason. And, you know, for the most part, my beta reader just go, yeah, okay. It's your decision. That's your choice. That was just a stylistic thing that I, you know, I was putting my own preference about. And very rarely, that has happened a couple of times, I said, no, I really do think you've changed it. And usually if someone is insisting something should be changed, they're usually right.
They might not be right about how you should go about it, and quite often they're not.
No.
But the idea that something should be changed, you know, quite often they are right, unless, as you say, it's a stylistic thing.
Yeah. And it is, for the most part, they'll be, If a beta reader gets abusive because you refuse to make the changes that they've suggested, then again, that might be a relationship you want to reconsider, unless you're just refusing to make any of the changes that they've suggested, in which case there's no point them being a beta reader because you're disregarding everything they're saying. So they probably feel cheated of their time. And that's probably a relationship you should end because neither of you are getting anything out of it.
Yeah, you should always approach critique from the position of accept, adapt, or reject. And you should approach it with your editing hat on, so you shouldn't be thinking as the writer who's really, really invested in that piece of writing and, you know, it's every word is struck gold kind of thing. You need to a little bit of distance in order to be able to look at it in a reasonable fashion, I think.
Yeah.
So writing relationships can change. You might, at some point, decide that you've done a fair bit of writing and you'd actually like to write something with somebody else.
Yep, and that's fair.
Which can be a lot of fun, quite interesting, and a bit of a mess in roughly that order.
Now you've obviously had experience with this, Jules, and you know we mentioned Matt beforehand. You wrote a couple of books with him.
Yeah. Matt is like my beta, do you want to build a snowman person? You're my alpha, do you want to build a snowman person?
Yeah.
So if there's a daft writing scheme, then Madeline's probably talked me into it.
What do you mean daft? We've always hit gold.
But Matt's very good at coming along and saying, oh, we should do something like this, which is how three anthologies happened, I'd like to point out. He's now tried that with a couple of other people and other anthologies are happening with other groups, which is great. But yeah. He also said, does anyone want to write a book with me about set around the Battle of Hastings? And I went, yeah, that sounds interesting. I'll give it a go. Not even thinking about what I was committing to at the time. And it turned into two books because we wrote so much and the publisher said, well, do you think it would make a duology instead?
And it did.
There is a faint possibility of a third book from a different character perspective at some point in the future, but we'll see how these ones land. But no, it's very, very interesting because we were taking two very different viewpoints and it was marrying two different voices and the two different viewpoints together and making sure that they crossed enough in the plot for actually to weave it together quite tightly. And also, it was historical fiction. And I like historical fiction, but when I write it, generally I put something weird in because I just can't help myself. It was really, really difficult keeping all the genetically engineered velociraptors out of the Battle of Hastings, for example.
Yeah.
And especially since Matt since then said, you know, we should have just left them in. No, it was great. And you do have that, well, you've got one person writing their half and the other person writing the other half, you're exchanging chapters, and we did it as a chapter exchange all the way through, which was good. It did mean that we kept sort of leapfrogging over each other time wise, and it did mean going out and then really sorting out the timeline at the end.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I remember sort of the comments made by, you know, Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett when they wrote Good Omens together.
Yeah.
About the fact that at some points neither of them could remember who'd written which part. You know, yeah. They were congratulating each other for writing the same part and them going, wait, if you didn't write it and I didn't write it, then who wrote it?
Yeah, and to be fair, you sort of look back on parts of Argument of Blood and A Black Matter for the King, and it's like, well, I know you must have written that bit, or I must have written this bit, but I genuinely don't really remember writing it. And it's
yeah.
After both parties have edited it and edited it together so that you sound seamless. It's definitely an experience that if you like working with other writers, I would recommend. And we have done a little bit of collaboration ourselves, haven't we?
Yes, we have. And we're going to hopefully do some more.
Yes.
I would like to sit down and write an actual book with you, Jules.
Yeah.
I think it would be epic.
It would be epic, which you might do. I mean, and another thing that you might do as a writer is you might write a world and then allow other writers to write within that world.
Yes. Or two writers might write different worlds and then decide they're the same one.
It's like, actually, maybe it is the same universe kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, something that we are sort of doing.
Yes, we are. And that's very exciting.
It's nice because you can have little crossovers with each other's series without, like, overcommitting or anything.
Yes. And I love my little crossovers. And another, you know, another example of how they've done that is just to look at the Marvel MCU, which is incredible. When you look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that's all set in the same world, and yet the stories are very individual, and the tones of the stories are very individual as well. And yet you will sometimes have characters crossing over.
Yeah, I mean, I read all the Jessica Jones Alias graphic novels at Christmas, and it was so weird to see all the other Marvel characters just popping up here, there and everywhere, but looked at very specifically from her very sort of dark, sarcastic, noir type viewpoint.
Yeah, exactly. And I also think, you know, even when you look at the movies, Captain America, the first movie, was very, very different from Iron Man, the first movie. Ant-Man is an incredibly different movie from Thor, you know?
Yeah, and they need to have different feels because of the different characters.
And yet they can all sort of come together. And that's another example of huge collaboration, whilst also leaving room for individual growth, taste, structure, style. And I feel that it's worked surprisingly well.
Yeah, I do agree with that.
The amount of beta readers they must have...
They must have teams of them, swarms.
Teams.
Yeah, it's, I think actually, if you put several writers together, you can either have a big mess or you can have something really epically awesome. And the way you'd get a big mess is where you don't get writers who all read each other's work or don't bother communicating with each other. So they're basically isolated writers that happen to be working on the same project rather than writers writing in tandem together. So instead of really collaborating, they're just sat there writing their own thing without regard for what the other writers are saying about the same thing.
Yeah, which never tends to take off very much.
That's where I fall down on the Star Wars books a bit, and I'm not a big fan of the Star Wars books anyway. But you have... I know for a fact that there are books that they all different... They sort of contradict each other.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's endless contradictions. Which again, you can have it, and you look at something, a long running series like Doctor Who, where the head writer, the torch is passed on over time, and sometimes there are contradictions, and then sometimes those contradictions have to be explained later on. It's very complex when you expand things in that way. And it's also why having beta readers is important, because beta readers are fans of your work, or of the work as it is. George R. R. Martin has to have a beta reader to keep up with all of the, with the humongous world he's built. And to be honest, I don't blame him.
No, can you imagine his piles of notes? I mean, they must be like mountainous.
Just mountainous. I mean, J.K. Rowling had to have a beta reader who went the whole way through just to look at the spells and make sure they were consistent. So, I mean, you can do that all yourself, but yeah, having a beta reader makes a difference. Really makes a difference.
It is time as well, and there will be things that you'll miss.
So, in summary, grab yourself a beta reader, tie them up, give them biscuits and tea, and you'll be happy.
You probably shouldn't tie them up.
Well, we're not tying up.
We on Dissecting Dragons are not advocating kidnapping and false imprisonment.
Speak for yourself, Jules. Jeez. No, we obviously no. It's a harmonious relationship, and it's an incredibly valuable one, and I cannot advocate it enough.
Yeah, it's a lot better and a lot easier with a writing buddy.
Yeah, especially if that writing buddy is happy and not tied up.
Okay.
So thank you for several years of being a writing buddiliness, Jules.
Well, thank you. Has it really been several years?
I don't know. It must be. We met in 2015, so it's now 2017.
Yeah, good point.
So it's at least been a year.
Before you know it, you'll be staying at each other's houses and having little sing-songs. And... that's not mandatory, by the way. Maybe that's just a weird thing that just happened with us. I don't know.
Shh. sharing weird things on TV and knitting tips. And on that note,
yeah, that's us catch done you for this week.
Catch you guys next week. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.